sera dine wati ko kizumo kabilo ido garidio adiani no tiepna bomo jagaba woi mako mwando tiepna vanwe jagaluo mginga
All right, if you're all up dancing, it's perfectly understandable. Kenyan music kind of does that to you. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a very special show today. My guest for the entire hour is Gugi Watthiongo, a good friend and a Kenyan writer, and one of the foremost writers in the world. And he's certainly one of the major voices coming out of Africa and African literature. He's also one of the most important writers dealing with the impact of colonialism and imperialism on the culture and thinking of oppressed people. And two of his most well-known books on this front are Decolonizing the Mind and Pen Points, Gunpoints, and Dreams. Gugi, your work has always sort of centered on something that's a major question in the world today. It has been since you were a youth and has continued to be a major question, and that is the oppression of the vast majority of the world by imperialism, and in particular in the realm of culture, in the realm of writing, in the realm of people actually having a way to identify themselves and stand up and fight. And I wanted to welcome you to the show, first off.
Thank you.
For people who aren't familiar with Gugi's work, he's written probably close to 36 pieces, novels, plays, children's books, critical essays, all kinds of things. And he's currently down at UCI in UC Irvine. But Gugi, let's start off talking about this. There's a quote from one of your works. It says, "The oppressed and the exploited of the earth maintain their defiance, liberty from theft, but the biggest weapon wielded and actually daily unleashed by imperialism against that collective defiance is the cultural bomb." What are you saying here?
Well, you know, as the way I look at literature and culture and economics and politics is that they are all interrelated, and that the economic aspects of a community are connected to political aspects, and those are also intimately connected with the cultural aspects. In other words, culture arises out of the economic and political evolution of a community, while also reflecting that, you know, evolution. Now, culture, taking the whole realm of culture from, say, language to music to dance to education systems to history to religious systems, embodies the values held by a community, you know, their aesthetic values, their ethical values, their concepts of what is right and wrong, what is heroic and not heroic. And that realm of values is the basis of a community's self-conception, or rather, the basis of their self-definition as a community, both collectively and also individually, so that the realm we refer to as identity really resides in that psychic realm, you know, of values which reside in the cultural realm and so on. Now, one of the ways an oppressing social section utilizes, you know, is to use a weapon of culture, actually, you know. Of course, the aim of any domination, say colonial domination, is for economic and political control. But economic and political control are never really, you know, complete without, you know, cultural control, you know, which means control of the whole realm of values, and ultimately to make the oppressed see themselves through the eyeglasses of the oppressing sector. If the oppressing sector can succeed in making the oppressed see themselves through the world view of the dominating, then such oppression and domination will be complete. So the aim, when I talk about cultural, bomb, I'm talking about that system, say, colonial system, which wipes out literally, people's, languages, people's concept of history, their education system, sometimes their religious system, that wipes out the capacity of those people to define themselves and be able to fight out the that system of oppression. So in that sense, it is a cultural bomb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the devastating impact of that is, it's incredible when you think about that, about what it sentences people to for the rest of their lives. And actually, one of the things, that quote, I think, if I'm correct, came from one of the books that had a major impact on my life, and I think had a major impact on many people I know, which is Decolonizing the Mind. And, I wanted to talk a little bit about that, that cultural bomb in terms of what did that look like in Kenya?
In fact, you're right to focus on decolonizing the mind, because actually I think I use the image of the cultural bomb in the context of, of language, mm-hmm. the way, for instance, the languages from, Africa, Asia, and to a certain extent in Latin America are really, marginalized, to the extent in some cases of, of being wiped out altogether. But even where they are alive and, they are part of the language of communication, the language of culture of the people, the tendency is to have them, marginalized. And most important, the tendency is to get the intellectuals of those communities, making their intellectual production in English or French or Portuguese. Yeah. So because of the centrality of language in our lives, in the organization of wealth in society, in the organization of power in society, in the organization of values in society, I thought that, I took it that, the wiping out of people's languages, again, is an aspect of that, cultural bomb. So the text, the quote, really is part of my arguments in decolonizing the mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a very important one. Let me take a minute to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with one of the major African, specifically Kenyan writers in the world today. More correctly, one of the major writers in the world today, Gugi Wa Thiong'o. Now, Gugi, in terms of you and your experience when you were growing up, what did it mean for the imperialists to have dropped the cultural bomb in Kenya? What did it look like?
Let me put it this way. Kenya, where I come from, was colonized by the British from about 1895 to 1963 when we got our independence. Kenya was a white settler colony. There were, of course, two types of colonies in Africa and, I suppose, in the world. There's a settler type where a sizable European population settled on the lands formerly owned by Africans. And there was, of course, the more commercial, protectory type of colonies, say, like in Nigeria, where, for instance, the colonial state functioned indirectly through some native institutions. But in a settler state, the colonial state was controlled directly by the European settlers. And it was the same in Kenya, the same, I believe, in Zimbabwe. And of course, we know the case of South Africa even better. Now, for us in Kenya, the cultural bomb or cultural control took literally the form of suppression of people's dances. And let me give you an example. I went to fairly, you know, well endowed, you know, and secondary school in Kenya, where if I remember right, or that I remember actually very clearly, we were not allowed to do African dances, where they were actually banned. The drum was banned, but we could do Scottish country, you know, dancing, for instance. That was normal. That was Christian. That was proper. But African dances in an African school were not, you know, proper. They were not the right thing, you know, to do, you know. In terms of language, you know, a child could go to school having been speaking their own African languages, you know, the languages of the community from which he or she comes, you know. But in the school environment, such a child was not allowed to speak his or her, you know, native language. In most cases, children who were caught speaking their own African languages were often humiliated, you know, sometimes given corporal punishment, so that such a child grew up associating his language with negativity, you know. On the other hand, when the same child did very well in English, he or she was elevated, given prizes, you know, and pointed to as a model of, you know, intelligence and modernity, you know. So what's really happening here is not that there's anything wrong in English language. It's a very, very important language. But there's something wrong, you can see, in the process of acquiring English through suppression of one's own native, you know, tongue and so on. In other words, here, it was not simply a question of learning English language. It was more a question of, you know, of suppressing African languages and the cultures, you know, that they, you know, that they carried. Mm-hmm. And some of these things, believe me, leave, you know, scars in the mind of the colonized.
Yeah, certainly. Uh-huh. And it has impact on, I mean, even like you're saying, that the fact that even people's careers or what they did in their, with their life, what they were allowed to do with their life, everything was funneled through their ability to master the language of the colonizer, to master the English language.
Yeah.
Know?
But again, I repeat, is to master it at the expense of right. the other languages. In other words, we're talking about the relations of power between, you know, between languages, you know. It's not English language per se, or French, because insofar as they are languages, I mean, they're the same as all other languages. They have some, you know, very important heritages that people can learn from and so on. They can become, they are also languages of communication. But in that sense, they are no different from, say, you know, Gujarati or Gikuyu or Kiswahili or Zulu. They happen to be languages of imperialist power, you know, or colonial power, you know, and to that extent, when they express their colonial powerfulness in least to African languages, you know, they tend to do a lot of damage to the colonized, you know, at the psychological level or at the level of conception of self.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind people that I'm talking with Gugi Watthiongo today, a writer from Kenya who's currently based in Irvine, California. Gugi, you actually, having gone through this whole process of being trained in English at the expense of your own language, and you came from your background, you came from a poor peasant family, and your family and you, to a certain extent, everything you've done has always been very close to the struggle of the people in Kenya for liberation. But you wrote your last, I guess your last novel in English was Petals of Blood, which is many people in this country know it and love it, and it was a really just a, you know, a hallmark work for people all over the world. But you wrote, you started writing in Gikuyu not until 1977. That was after 17 years of writing in English. You said that this was part and parcel. Doing that, taking that move to writing Gikuyu was actually it was part of the anti-imperialist struggle. What led you to do that, and why would you say it was part of the anti-imperialist struggle?
You know, first of all, let me explain that. You know, the result of the kind of language education we had, you know, in Kenya and in Africa and in the colonized world as a whole, was to the result of that kind of education was to produce intellectuals, you know, who can only function in English or French or Portuguese. In other words, the intellectual production of, say, a third world intellectual is in languages which are not necessarily the language of common speech, you know. So third world peoples, or say Asian and African peoples, produce intellectuals, they pay for intellectuals who go and acquire knowledge at colleges and universities all over the world, but then they produce that knowledge and store it in what I call linguistic, you know, prisons, prison houses of English and French. I call them linguistic prison houses because once that knowledge is stored there, it's not necessarily available to the people who most need it. That the people whose language of communication, of cultural expression, you know, are languages other than the French and the English in which that knowledge is, you know, actually stored. We can see this very clearly in the production of African literature, for instance. In my own case, you know, when I started to write, which was actually in the early 60s, my first four novels, you know, The River Between, Weep Not Child, A Grain of Wheat, and Petals of Blood, were in English language. And yet, the novels, the narratives, you know, were talking about the struggles of Kenyan people. You know, they're talking about the peasants and the workers, you know, who some of them took up arms through Mau Mau to oust the British, you know, colonial state. When they were fighting or organizing, they were not theorizing their position in English or French. Surely they must have been using African languages. And yet my novels, which were talking about those struggles, you know, were constructed in English language. And the question arose then for me, you know, what was the audience assumed by my choice of English as a medium of my novelistic, you know, intervention in our own society?
Yeah, that's in fact, that's a very important question I wanted to get into right there. But before we do, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back to talk about this question of the audience, the for whom you were writing, the impact of language on that, and a pretty special, important turning point in your life. And we'll get into that in just a second after this short break. Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and if you're just now joining us, we're talking with Kenyan-born and world-based novelist, playwright, and cultural theorist, Ngugi wa Thiong'o. And we're talking with him about his work, about the question of language in literature, language of the oppressed people in colonies and neo-colonies, language as an essential part of the struggle against imperialist domination. Ngugi, one of the things that we started to talk about was the difference that it makes in terms of speaking and doing your work in an indigenous language, doing your work in Gikuyu, what difference it meant in terms of being able to reach the workers and peasants who actually, in any society, as you're saying, like with Mau Mau, with all this, these were the agents of change, but they were the people that imperialist domination had separated the intellectuals off from, had really made a major disconnect. So there was no, people were writing and producing some good things. The question was that it wasn't available to the people. And so you sort of made a break with that.
Yeah, it's the whole question of colonial division of the mind from the body, as it were, you know, the separation of the two, the head and the hand, mm-hmm. you know, being, you know, separated, you know. What in my own case, actually what made me change that position was my work at Camarillo Community Education and Cultural Center, you know, which was located about 30 kilometers from the capital city of Nairobi. This, I believe, was 1976. I was then an associate professor of literature at the University of Nairobi, as well as chairperson of the department. But some of us intellectuals, out of various things that I won't go into just now, decided to work in the villages as well. While working in Nairobi, we also moved into the villages, you know, to be at the centers of the production of culture. And that's when the issue of language first confronted me in a very practical way. Because if we were going to work in that village, Camarillo, what language were we going to use? Of course, we had common sense, logic actually demanded that we use the language of the area. In this case, you know, it was Kikuyu language. And it was really one of the most important experiences of my life as a writer and intellectual, you know, because working with the people who are using their own language, you know, English language ceases to be that which divides the intellectual from the people and so on. You could actually operate within the same, you know, language. And what we brought to the common table of our experience, you know, were our different, you know, experiences, whether at the university or at the factory or in the fields, you know, and so on, you know. But something else happened to me. I discovered that I really knew very little about my own language, Gikuyu language. And during that period when I worked at Camarillo with peasants and workers, you know, I really came to learn my language and to develop a completely new relationship to my language, you know. But the neo-colonial government of Kenya, you know, did not see it that way. As you may know, I was myself later. The play, the experiment at Camarillo was stopped. And I myself was later, the same year, 1977, put in a maximum security prison where I stayed for a whole year, you know, in 1978. And it was while I was actually at committee maximum security prison, no charges, no formal charges, you know, no appearance in a court of law, not even police questioning. I was just damned in a cell located between the section for those condemned and the other section for the mentally, you know, deranged. It was while I was there that I decided that as part of my own resistance, you know, I would no longer write any fiction or poetry in English, that from then onwards, I would write in the very language which had been the basis of my incarceration. You know, and that's how I came to write my first novel, you know, Devil on the Cross, Shaitan Madarafaine, Devil on the Cross in English translation, on the only material then available to me in prison, which was toilet paper. But it was a very, very important act of resistance, but also in my own case, my own life, you know, had tremendous impact on my own life, you know. But even moving from just fiction to poetry, you can see the contradiction in the African situation when intellectual production is only in English and French. Say now, for instance, Africa is devastated by AIDS and so on, you know. What is the point of our leading medical experts putting their knowledge of medicine in English, you know, when the people most affected by that devastation are not simply English speakers, they also, the majority are speakers of, African languages. Or, say, in the case of Kenya, and, you know, agriculture is the mainstay, you know, of the economy. So the people who most need the latest thoughts or the latest ideas on agriculture, you know, are the ordinary man and woman working in the fields, you know, on their own lands and so on. But our, say, the latest graduates, our graduates from universities where they study the latest in theory and practice in agriculture, you know, and where they do research, end up writing the results of that in English and French. So that knowledge is never really available to the people who actually need it. So it's not simply a question of literature and fiction and poetry. It's not a question of actually that which would actually empower people as their social agents for change.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with the writer Gugi Wathiongo. Gugi, I think you're right. And at the same time, I mean, the point about actually even with, like, as we're talking about culture and fiction and poetry and all, and whatnot, I think your point is really well taken. But I also think that there's a point here about people dreaming, you know, the ideological role of art, of fiction, of literature, of helping people develop that view of themselves in relation to the world. And one of the things I was really impressed with, because actually you kind of went over the experience in the village, you kind of didn't mention what the play was, which I think also I've read it many times, and having reread it just preparing for this, it's such a good friend. You know, I just thought that the content of this had a lot to do both with what you were taking to the peasants and also why the government got angry and decided to throw you in jail.
Yeah, because we're asking people to look at their own history, not look at as history as being made for them by anybody, but history as they made it. In fact, the script of I Will Marry When I Want, which is the English translation of the Gikuyu original, Gahika Deda, was actually developed together with the peasants and the workers, you know, of that particular village. Often the play drew on their own lives, particularly the lives of those who were working as, you know, agricultural workers on plantations owned by multinational corporations, or working in a industry, you know, sectors, you know, of the area. We're saying, let us sing about what we have done in history, not what others have done for us, not what the government has done for us, not what the big people in the city have done for us, but what we have done. We are the makers of history was really, in so many ways, the theme of this particular, you know, play. Now, you talk about the role of art. Yeah, of course, art has functions, you know, more practical functions, but even more important, and it's itself a material force, is creating dreams, you know, for when people are living under dire, you know, sort of economic and political circumstances, you know, you must create dreams that keep hope alive, you know. Another way, you must also, I think art has to create magic in the ordinary, you know, so that people are made to look at what surrounds them, you know, once again, but with different, you know, eyes, you know. Particularly with eyes that say, yes, we can actually transform what is around us, you know. We can actually change ourselves. We can actually change, you know, our social lives. We can actually have a better quality of human life, both in a material sense and also in a spiritual, you know, sense. So dreams are a very, very important part of our being. And when you kill a people's dreams, you kill the basis of hope. The basis of hope. Dreams are very important. Dreams are tied up with tomorrow, with what's possible, with what could come, you know, in the future.
I think this point you're just making, that if you kill a people's dreams, you kill the basis of hope, is a really important point. It does seem that one of the things that weighs heaviest on oppressed people is whether or not they see the possibility of ever ending that oppression. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
There is a war going on for your mind. Media mavens mount surgical strikes from trapper keeper collages and online magazine racks. CoverGirl cutouts throw up pop-up ads infecting victims with silicone shrapnel. Worldwide passenger pigeons deployed paratroopers. Now it's raining pornography. Lovers take shelter. Post-production debutantes pursue you in NASCAR chariots. They construct ransom letters from biblical passages and bleed mascara into the holy water supplies. There is a war going on for your mind. Industry insiders slang test tube babies to corporate crackheads. They flash logos and blast ghettos. Their embroidered neckties say, stop snitching. Conscious rappers and whistleblowers get snitches made of acupuncture needles and marionette strings. There is a war going on for your mind. Professional wrestlers and vice presidents want you to believe them. The desert sky is their blue screen. They superimpose explosions. They shout at you. Pay no attention to the men behind the barbed curtain, nor the craters beneath the draped flags. Those hoods are there for your protection, and the meteors these days are the size of corpses. There is a war going on for your mind.
We are the insurgents.
Welcome back. That was the Flobots with There's a War Going On for Your Mind from their CD, Fight with Tools. I'm Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Gugi Wathiongo, a former political prisoner, one of the greatest writers to come out of Africa in the last century, I think, and I think there's millions of people around the world that agree with me, and he's currently down at Irvine. I wanted to actually let you know that we got a caller while we've been talking, and this person said that when you were released from prison, he was one of the people who carried you through the streets, and he's so happy to hear you, to hear your voice, to hear you talking on the station.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, when I was actually came from prison, from actual maximum security prison in 1979, yeah. I was in prison from December 77 to December 78. You know, when I went to speak at the University of Nairobi, you know, the students, you know, and literally carried me shoulder high, and we walked through the streets of Nairobi, and I have always appreciated, you know, that moment, because it's very spontaneous. You know, it's really an expression, you know, of solidarity. And I've always hoped, and that as a writer, I hope I never, in my writing, betray that solidarity, which, you know,
your love for the people certainly stands out very, very high, and I think people everywhere know that. And people who read your work, you can't come away without knowing that. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you is, when we were talking earlier, I had mentioned that the great Chinese writer Lu Xun, that when he started writing in the vernacular of the common people in China, with the express purpose of getting these ideas, getting these dreams, getting all this to the common people, and actually also learning from them and taking up their things and seeing how that could be concentrated and transformed into dreams for people, you know, that was a very radical act at that time even. And it concentrated a lot of things and had impact all around the world. And in Kenya, it also had a major impact on you, because if I'm not mistaken, you are one of the only writers I know of in the world who had a police arrest warrant issued for one of the major characters in your novel, right?
Yes, actually, first I should mention, you know, that the novel which I wrote on toilet paper at Kamete, maximum prison, maximum security prison, is called Shaitan Mudharavaine, and there's an English translation called Devil on the Cross. That came out actually in the early 80s, and the English translation came out in 1982, when I also left Kenya and have been exiled for the last 22 years until actually December last year, when we had a new government. But when I lived in London for some years, actually struggling for the release of political prisoners in Kenya, and alerting the world to the, you know, the repressive character of our regime. But I wrote a novel there when I was there called Matigari, you know, in Gikuyu language. And it was when it was published back in Kenya, people were talking about Matigari, a character who went around the country asking questions of truth and justice, but we're talking of him as if he was a real living person. So the government under Arap Moi sent police to arrest Matty Gari, only to find that he was a character in fiction. So, amazingly, they arrested the book instead. In 1987, I think the book was taken from all the shelves in all the bookshops in Kenya at the time.
Amazing.
Matty Gari.
Well, one of the things that you talk about in relation to that, too, is that you've made the point that actually taking up this kind of language and going to the people has, it makes a writer subversive in the eyes of these neocolonial regimes. And in particular, you've said that literature can't escape class power structures, shaping daily life no matter the intention or awareness of the writer. Every writer is a writer in politics. You can't be neutral. The question is what and whose politics. And when you make that choice, that's the choice that you have to make, not whether or not you're going to be in politics, but what are the what and whose politics are they. And when you make that choice, if you choose for the people, you become a subversive and the enemy of the state. What were you talking about there? Why do you think that?
No, sometimes there's a tendency, you know, particularly in the academy generally, to talk as if ideas, you know, exist in a realm all their own, you know, kind of surreal realm, you know. And I see ideas, you know, as products of our activities, you know, in society. And ideas, you know, rationalize one set of tendencies or practices, you know, as opposed to, you know, other, you know, practices, you know, and so on. So that even at the level of ideas, you know, to the extent that there are social divisions in society, that those social divisions are also reflected in the realm of ideas. Ideas, very, very important. Ideas, in fact, become a material force themselves, so that they are not actually removed from the materiality, you know, of a given, you know, society. And that's why, again, if you look at the colonial situation, you know, there was this systematic, you know, divorce, engineered directly or indirectly, you know, divorce between the intellectual production of ideas, you know, and the practical production of goods, you know, the two realms, you know, were, you know, separated, you know. And the problem we have in Africa today is that that division still, you know, goes on. So who benefits from that division? Surely it cannot be the peasant, the ordinary farmer, the ordinary worker, you know. It can only be another sector of that society, you know. And often it's a sector which actually is often allied with the global forces, you know, of global forces, you know, that hold back change that is to the benefit, you know, of the majority.
You know, yeah, and one question I actually wanted to pursue along those lines, actually, well, in relation to that, this question of, you know, there's a point here when you talk about the writer and the writer being in politics. And it reminded me a lot of the stuff that I had read that Mal wrote around the Anon Forum about questions of art and for whom and the audience, and also some of the problems about the stand that one takes towards what you see in the world, you know, because you are confronted with this stand. And that's what you had said before, is that, you know, you are confronted with this. How are you going to look at this? What attitude are you going to take about this? Were you familiar, actually, with the Anon Forum, with Mal's work in the Anon Forum?
Yeah, I think it's a very important, you know, document, that one. You know, and the most important question in that is really, again, the question for whom, you know, does one write? You know, but I assume that here, for whom one writes is not in the sense of, oh, that I write a novel today and tomorrow there will be a social revolution, you know.
Right,
or,
right.
Again, it's in that whole realm of the struggle of, you know, of ideas, you know, of conception, you know, of the world, you know. And my belief is, you know, quite frankly, literature, culture should empower human beings to change the conditions of their lives and to intensify their spiritual experience of life, or rather, their spirituality.
I think that's what I was getting at when I was talking about the question of the ideological impact of art and the ideological role of art, to a large extent. Quick reminder, we're talking with the writer Gugi Wathiongo about his life and his work, his views on art and politics, and the intersection of the two. One thing I'd like to ask you is, when you do this, when you started writing in Kikuyu, what was the response? I mean, here you were, you wrote to reach the masses of peasants and workers throughout Kenya. What was the response you got from them?
First of all, I must say, of course, you know, we must also see this in the perspective that apart from the linguistic division, there's also the problem of literacy, you know, that the kind of people not being able to read and write, you know. And when I produced my novel in Gikuyu, Devil on the Cross, and later Matigari, you know, and the play Gaika Deda, were actually, you know, published, they were actually read, you know, in groups at home and in factory yards, you know, in buses, in public transport, for instance, you know, and a more literate, you know, person would read, you know, for those who were not, you know, who could not read or write, you know. So there's a way in which the text was appropriated by the oral tradition. Here's a case of orality actually appropriating, you know, the literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, what a trip. That's great. So somebody who could read would actually then share this with all
these
people.
Yes, that was really something which was very, very moving indeed, you know. And the same thing actually happened to a large extent, to a certain extent, with Matigari, which came out in 1986 and was arrested in 1987. During that very brief period, you know, again, people were reading, you know, to each other and discussing, you know, the novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, I know we're moving kind of quick here, and there's so much. I keep looking at all the things I had outlined to talk with you about, and there's so much I want to pursue. One of the things, though, is that there is a question here. When you started to write in Kikuyu, there actually was this, there was a set, you were going into a field, you were going into an area where there hadn't been a body of African literature produced in Kikuyu. You know, there wasn't a body of African literature, really, to a large extent. And you faced certain problems. And I'd like to hear, you said that was both liberating and very challenging. And I imagine part of it was in the question of, you know, there's always problems with translation where you try to capture feeling, but also, you know, and you miss something. But there's also, in terms of you go into the language and where you haven't been writing in that, the idea of trying to capture everything, as you said once, that in writing one should hear all the whispering and shouting and crying and the loving and the hating of the many voices of the past, and those voices will never speak to you in a foreign language. But if you don't have that experience and that knowledge of building up this literature, this body of literature in that language, it must be very challenging.
Yeah, very challenging indeed. In this case, in our case at Camarillo in the 70s, or in my own case, when I started actually learning from the people, my language and so on, you know, it was initially a problem, and the problem was psychological more than anything else, you know. I had never before encountered a novel in Kikuyu language, not encountered a major play in Kikuyu language, you know. And here I was, you know, trying to, together with the others, to construct, you know, a play, you know, in Kikuyu language, you know. And later, of course, when I wrote the novel, you know, words would play tricks with me. But later I realized it was more a matter of self-belief than, you know, anything else. But most important for me as a writer was opening myself to learning from the people in the village. You know, I literally loved going to markets, riding in public transport, being wherever people gathered, you know. And this acquired a very different meaning for me, being where people were, listening to how they spoke, you know, the phrases they used, the words they used, the stories they told, and so on, you know. I had a very, very different relationship to those, you know, stories, you know, than I had before, when I would listen to the same stories, but with a view to translating them into English, you know, language. So there was a challenge of writing in a language that one had not written before, you know, but more important, it was a challenge to my psyche, you know, to accept that intimacy with my language, you know, as the starting point.
So in a way, you had to overcome the impact of the cultural bomb that was dropped on the Kenyan people.
Yeah, the psychological alienation. There is a definite, you know, cultural alienation, psychic alienation, psychological alienation that you find in many intellectuals of the third world, you know, African intellectuals particularly, you know, who even when they are very, very well-meaning and progressive and so on, you know, but they cannot imagine themselves reading in their own language. They cannot imagine themselves producing ideas in their own language. You know, of course, the other arguments that are brought, you know, into this picture where people say, look, Africa has so many languages. It's true. We do have very many languages, you know, in Africa. But that one, that means only. But what does that say? It just says that there are peoples in Africa who speak different languages. Do we abolish those people in order to create the nation state or continental African unity? On the contrary, I believe we start with the reality of what people actually use, the languages that use, and then devise ways in which those languages can speak to each other. For instance, through the art of translation and so on. And if a novel, say, was originally available, say, in Luo or Kikuyu or Igbo or Yoruba, there's nothing wrong in that novel also being available, A, in other African languages, you know, and also in other languages like English or French and so on. That means the text can exist in various, you know, languages. There's no reason why, you know, a person who does research, say, on biological cell structures or whatever in Gikuyu, why that work as a scientific work cannot later be translated into other African languages and be available also in English, you know, and Portuguese and any other, you know, Spanish, any other, you know, language, you know, in the world.
We're going to take a short break and be right back to continue our conversation with Gugi Wathiongo. Welcome back. That was Rokoto Frenzy by Abdul TJ's Rokoto. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Gugi Wathiongo, one of the first African writers to insist on writing in his own language as part of the struggle against colonial and neocolonial oppression. He's written dozens of novels, plays, poems, and theoretical essays over the past 50 years, and they've been read by many millions of people around the world. Gugi, following up on the point you were making just before the break about the importance of writing in one's own language, but also of this work then being made widely available in as many languages as possible, one of the things you speak to in your theoretical work, Pen Points, Gun Points, and Dreams, and I think you also make the same point in Decolonizing the Mind. On that basis, and especially on the basis of all of these different languages, and the, if they're written for the audience of peasants and workers, and they start to bring out a universality among people of the world when this stuff gets translated into, you know, when people's dreams are written and then they get translated into other languages and people begin to develop some real unity there.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in, for instance, in what we're trying to develop as a model, by the way, in the International Center for Writing Translation at the University of California, Irvine, you know, a model for what we call marginalized languages, you know, talking to each other, a conversation, a dialogue among, you know, marginalized languages. I would like, for instance, to see, works in Chinese, in Korean, in Gujarati, in Spanish, you know, in English, you know, in French, available, say, in any one African language, also in my own case, say, in Gikuyu language, you know. But there's no reason those availability of progressive culture in the various languages of the world, you know, available in any one of the languages of the world, you know, is an enriching experience. You know, we live in the same world, you know, the world is shrinking, so to speak. You know, there's this notion of one neighborhood, and it's true, but that neighborhood does not have to express itself entirely in on one language, you know. We can express ourselves in different languages, you know, like a field of different flowers, which have different colors, you know, they have even different shapes, but they are no less flowers for being, having different flowers. But they express the universality of their floweriness, if you like, you know, in different colors and shapes and so on. And it's no flower which, on account of its color, that I can say that it's more of a flower than another flower. You know, it assumes equality, if you like, you know, of flowers, even when they are shaped differently and are in different, you know, colors. You know.
This is the big question. You have spent a lot of time in your work actually talking about the relationship between art and the state, and in particular in Pinpoint, Gunpoints, and Dreams, you've delved into that quite deeply. What is your view of the relationship between art and the state?
Yeah. First, of course, we are talking about, you know, art and power, you know, and here in, by the way, these lectures which I gave at Oxford in England, you know, what they call Clarendon Lectures in English, and I spoke about the entire relation between, you know, art, you know, and the state. And my way of looking at art is that there's a way in which is real art, by its very nature as art, is in alliance with change. You know, you can't think of, if you come across a painting which has no movement in it, which does not express movement, or sculpture that does not express movement in it, you know that it's a dead sculpture, it's a dead painting, it's not, you know, it's not really a work of art. You know, look at dance, literature, even when the formal elements may be retrogressive, you know, but what they embody as art is movement. And the state, as a state, even the most progressive state, of course, embodies conservation of what is. So the art is always talking about the possibility of what could be, you know, while the state is trying to preserve what is, to hold back. In other words, you know. So the way I looked at it, I see there's inherent oppositional relationship between the two. But it does not mean that they... but they're also trying to co-opt each other. And they're not always in conflict, because the state is also trying to co-opt art, you know, well, and the other
also,
way around.
And also, if you have... I mean, actually, that's one of the things that's been... You know, I know there's been, like, sort of... You know, it's been a very difficult, very thorny question to deal with in a socialist society, for instance. And I know in China they tried to deal with that some in the Cultural Revolution. And the idea that art actually, on the one hand, it is part of it by its very nature is forging what's new and actually sometimes seeing things from it has a skewering kind of role in society. And it sees things from a different angle and can point out where there's shortcomings, where there's, you know, there's problems and things need to be changed. And it can help forge some new thinking. And so when you have a society, which we haven't had, really a society where, you know, and we've had it in a couple of times, but this question of actually the vast majority of people doing, you know, being the government representing or the state representing the vast majority of the people and the role of art in relation to that, it's a little bit different, but I think. And before we go, we're going to go real quick, and there's just something I really wanted to end with that I think is just an incredible, something that captured a lot of your work for me, and that is you quote Martin Carter of Guyana, and you say, Martin Carter has talked equally eloquently about all those who sleep not to dream, but dream to change the world. The question is, change it to what and for whom? For me, dreaming to change the conditions that confine human life is the mission of art, and it is often in conflict with that of the state as we have known it up to now in Africa and the world. In such a situation, art has the right to take up pen points to write down our dreams for a world in which, at the very least, there are no prisons and gunpoints. Gugi Wathiongo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
What a remarkable hour. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I want to thank Gugi Wathiongo for being here and for all of his work. Gugi has a new book coming out sometime in March, the first volume of his memoir, and I really look forward to checking it out and perhaps having him back to talk about it. Googie made a point in this interview that if you crush dreams, then you crush the human spirit, and the idea that something better is possible disappears. I think that's an important point for all of us to chew on for a while. The world does cry out for radical and revolutionary change. We as humans not only need a whole new world, we deserve it. So let's keep dreaming and striving for that world. It's up to us. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I'd like to thank Age and Christine Blasdale for the production assistance, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. You know, I really would like to hear from people. Maybe you have an idea for a show. Maybe you want to get involved in producing and developing the show. Drop me a note, and we'll go from there. We're going to go out now with a piece called Someday Soon, Sweet Samba from Abdullah Ibrahim. Thank you.